Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Brinker.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all.
Minutes, motion for the minutes?
Yep, move first.
We're approving two sets of minutes, I believe.
Yeah, first for June 17.
Second?
On favor?
Aye.
Second set?
Approve the emergency meeting of July 2nd, 2020. I probably should abstain.
I move to approve the minutes from the July 2nd emergency meeting.
All in favor?
Aye.
To report, Bill.
Right, thank you. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Should be pulling up early. These numbers are through June 30th, so first half of the year. Thanks, David. Okay, just a quick note on the property taxes. No change from last month, but we are about $1.5 million behind where we were at this point in 2019. So hopefully that is all timing related from what we've been hearing from the county, but nonetheless, that does affect cash flow. We do have on the grants and gifts in local government, timing of reimbursements from Tiger, CMAC, and NOAACA reduced the difference about $1.8 million in June to $3.3 million from 2020. But these are all restricted money, so it's important to note that the surplus here is not helpful for our general operations. These are specific mostly for capital projects. When we look at the charges for services, we gained about another $1.1 million in June, now about $4.2 million over 2020, which we just are coming out of the period of shutdown from March through June last year. And I think we're going to start to see this erode a little bit in July and August. We have other activities that we're competing with now, and we'll take a look at the individual numbers when we get to zoo and golf to see where that's happening. And we are about $240,000 behind where we were in 2019.
Bill, in a normal year, what would that have been in a normal non-COVID year? Instead of, say 12 or 8, or would it be considerably higher than that, or?
It would not be considerably higher than that. 2019 was about 240 grand higher than this, than 2020. 2019 was a quote, kind of normal year.
Yeah.
One of our better years from a weather perspective. So if we kind of said 12 million would be about the norm right now, maybe 13, in a bad weather year, that number could be 10 or 11. But we had pretty strong weather in 19. We had good participation. So that's a fair representation. And we've, prior to COVID, we were budgeting roughly $30, $31 million, if I recall correctly, for charges for services. So being at the $13 million mark coming through June is, I think, a pretty fair representation.
Particularly with so much closed and so worker situation.
Correct.
Very good.
Yes. And looking at total, before we get to total revenue, I probably should have mentioned the self-insured health insurance, even though it's not highlighted here. You can see that the revenue is down $374,000 from where we were last year. This is where we flowed through the rebate that we provided to employees. And even though it's jumping around a little bit, if we take a look down at the self-insured expense, we can see that it's also an unfavorable number there of about $381,000 with increased claim activity this year. So that's a total unfavorable swing of about $720,000 on the self-insured health insurance perspective this year from where we were in 2020. But back up on total revenue, we are up about $6.2 million from last year. We're about $3.9 million over 2019. And again, that's driven by the restricted fund activity, which is particular for capital and not general operations. As we move to our total operating expenses, we're about $164,000 greater than 2020. We are $5.3 million less than 2019, given the timing and difficulty in hiring our seasonals and some other reduced operational costs. Payroll made up about $3.3 million of that. Operations made up about $2 million of that. Payroll's going to start catching up to the 2019 levels with July payrolls. We'll start to see that difference become smaller. And then from an operating surplus perspective, we're running about $6 million higher than 2020. June saw an unfavorable swing of about $2.5 million and about $9 million better than 2019, which is no change from last month. mostly due to the restricted funds and significantly reduced by capital expenditures, which we'll see down below. CapEx, speaking of, is about $1.5 million more than last year and about $5 million more than 2019. So what that does from a net surplus perspective is it puts us about $4.6 million more than last year and about $4 million more than 2019 from the restricted fund activity. Moving to the zoo, we're about $2.5 million greater than 2020, but we are about $71,000 less than 2019. This is where I think we start to see the trend of people having other things to do. They can go to sporting events, they can go to other type of entertainment venues, and we're competing with all the things that are now open. From an operating expense perspective, we are about $82,000 less than 2020, about $1.4 million less than 2019. But again, as we see some of the payroll changes start coming through in July, that should start to mitigate a little bit and get closer to 19 numbers. The operating subsidy is about $2.6 million better than 2020, about $1.3 million better than 2019. And both of these were real similar to where we were last month, not much change on a monthly basis, which you can see here. Jumping down to capital expenditures, about $710,000 less than 2020. And our net subsidy is currently about $4 million. It was $7.3 million in 2020 at this point, and it was about $6.5 million in 2019. Looking at golf, we can compare golf to 2020 since these are both basically full years from the golf front. Rounds are actually down about 6% for the month of June, which means they're up about 25% year to date. So like the zoo, we are starting to see some of the other activities perhaps affecting us. So we'll keep an eye on July and August and what happens to the golf numbers. Revenue is up about $1.03 million over 2020. That reduced about $400,000 from last month. And on the operating expense side, we're about $363,000 greater than 2020 as we support that higher revenue activity. The operating surplus is about $667,000 better than 2020, and that's down from $794,000 last month. And then jumping down to the net surplus perspective, we are about $721,000 better than last year after capital expenditures. We will see that decrease as we watch our capital expenditure numbers come through, some of which will be coming through this month for Big Met and the cart paths.
Now, at this point of the year, would that be about even then?
I'll have to look and see exactly what we have. If we do everything that we thought about doing earlier in the year, we will be a little bit closer. It's going to depend on the timing with construction materials being so difficult to get and with prices being so high. If we defer some of those projects this year, we may come in less than what we've done in the past from a capital expenditure perspective. I'm expecting a little bit of that. I think if we're watching our dollars, we're going to need to defer a little bit because costs and availability are so challenging now. On a per course basis, you can see here again, green indicates that our revenue and our operating surplus performance is better than it was the same period last year. I'll just mention with Little Met, where it looks like our operating expenses are so much higher, this is mainly because of seasonal timing. If you'll recall, we were late in opening Little Met last year and resources that we put towards it, given that it was during the pandemic time.
But we still brought in that much revenue last year.
We did. That's correct. Once it opened up, really all the courses opened up kind of in a flurry last year, total concentration of nothing else to do, frankly. And it was an availability for people to get outside in a safe environment because it was outdoors. So as soon as we did open up the courses, all of them respectively, they performed pretty quickly and pretty well. But as you can see here, we had the same kind of start this year too. And we really had, up until this month, we really had pretty remarkable weather, particularly on weekends as we came through. Looking at enterprise, revenue is up about $698,000 over 2020. It's actually down $866,000 from 2019, so approaching $1 million. We'll see on location per location where those differences are. Operating expenses are about $319,000 greater than 2020, about $585,000 less than 2019. So what that does from a surplus perspective is our operating surplus is up about $468,000 versus 2020, but it's down about $282,000 from 2019. And then not much capital activity. So when we jump down to here, the net surplus is about $213,000 roughly through half of the year. And then on a per location basis, for instance, if we look at Merwin's Wharf, even though the numbers are indicated as being green, it is now closed and revenue strong compared to last year. Obviously, everything was closed last year, but it's actually down $405,000 from 2019. And the operating margin is down almost $200,000 from 2019. Edgewater Beach House is down $150,000 from 2019. Operating margin is roughly the same. And this is where we're operating with limited food selections right now at Edgewater Beach House. East 55th Marina is very comparable to 2019. East 55th Restaurant is about $43,000 less and about $14,000 less in operating margin than 2019. Emerald Necklace Marina is pretty comparable to 19. Emerald Necklace Restaurant is down $136,000 and it's also down about $3,500 in operating margin. And again, this is another restaurant location, bless you, that is not full operations yet. It's mainly, you know, ice cream and small things that don't take a lot of kitchen staff to prepare. And as we jump to the next slide to see the rest of our locations, Edgewater Pier is about 24,000 behind 2019. In revenue, about 4,200 behind in operating margin. Wallace Lake is behind 11,000 from 2019, about 3.1K behind in operating margin. Huntington is down $37,000, or is actually up $37,000, excuse me, from 2019, now that we have the Noshery. And Ledge Lake is about 19,000 behind 2019 with a similar margin, and parking is about 22,000 behind 2019. And about 18,000 behind in margin. So you can see really almost all locations with the exception of Huntington are down from 2019, given our ability to either be limited staff with what we're offering or not offering at all in terms of Merwin's Wharf. And that is the first half results, unless there's any other questions.
So I think we have next, we have swearing in ceremony, right?
Yes, for general action items, the swearing in of patrol officers Kara A. Ditch and James P. Moore, if they could please come forward.
I and then state your name. I solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution, the laws of the United States of America, Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio, regulations of the Cleveland Metro Parks. Boxes you in, it doesn't fit. And will discharge the duties of the officer of the office of the police officer, which I've been appointed. Best of my ability, I will faithfully carry out and implement the policies enunciated. Instructions given to me by the Board of Park Commissioners of the Cleveland Metro Park District. This I promise to do as I shall answer unto God. Congratulations.
While Kara and James sign their paperwork, Kara joins the Cleveland Metro Parks after graduating from Polaris Police Academy. She holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Ohio Northern. She most recently worked for us in our park maintenance division. James Moore is joining us from Lorain Community Police Academy, where he won the Top Driver Award. It's applause. Sounds good.
Is that golf? Or
yeah.
Is that,
I think it could mean lots of different things. He also He also has an associate degree from Lorraine Community College, and he's most recently held a part-time police officer with Huron PD. So we congratulate both of them. The appointment falls on the mid portion of page 9, appointing Kara A. Ditch and James P. Moore as full-time police officers under the Ohio Revised Code 15-45-13.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Congratulations.
Driving a car, is that what that is?
Yes.
I didn't hear about that.
Congratulations to both of you, and we wish you the best of luck. The next action item is budget adjustment number 7. Bill?
Thanks, Brian. Budget adjustment number 7 is for $2,673,703. $2.2 million of this is from existing restricted funds, majority of which are for the zip line and land acquisition. $277,000 is from new restricted funds and grants. About $87,000 is from insurance proceeds, and about $20,000 is from an increase in revenue. An explanation of the adjustments by category are on pages 27 through 29, and the recommended action falls on the top of page 10 of the agenda.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the ratification of collective bargaining agreements with Cleveland Metro Parks Employees Association. This is actually two agreements. The first one is a one-year contract extension, January 20 through December 31st of 2020. It contains no changes to the prior contract. The next agreement is for a three-year contract with CMEA starting. We most recently negotiated out in the first part of July. Contract wages include 3.5%, 2.5%, 2.5%, contingent on the passage of the levy, and all of the things essentially hold true. The recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 10 to ratify the contracts.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the authorization to enter into an affiliate agreement for horseback riding at the Event Center. This is a process that's been going on for more than 4 years with our group at CAD, Classic Attraction Dressage Society. They have performed very well with a very organized and thoughtful mission, and they really fall kind of under our Lake Erie Nature and Science Center, Bay Arts, Crooked River Archers, and the Foundry. We would like to enter into a license agreement with them. Dave is here if you'd like to speak on behalf of his group before we vote on this. Anything you'd like to say? Dave, if you'd like to come up here to the microphone, just to make sure that we're on. Yep.
We don't do any boarding. We don't do any training. And we do massage. We had a big show back in June where we actually drew people from. So we do about 2 to 3 events a month. A facility is unbelievably perfect. Indoor arena, the outdoor arena, we've done a lot of work there, you know, make it better. We open everything up to anybody that wants to come. So, you know, continuation of this agreement is very important to us. And when presented the option of status, it really presented. So.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. There are no questions from the board. The recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 12 to enter into an agreement with CADS as an affiliate and granting its license to use the area identified as the Brecksville Stables.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is an authorization of a land acquisition. This is the Barnes property. This is in the Brecksville Reservation. David brings up a map of it. You will see how strategic this is. We have talked with the city of North Royalton. In fact, the mayor alerted us to the potential sale of this property. We continue to look to bolster land along the Bennett Road corridor that connects to the Valley Parkway along the way. Do you have the map? If not, that's not the biggest deal. There we go. So we can see where the Cleveland Metro Parks part is. That was actually a donation from the city of North Royalton. This continues to add the connection. The purple line is part of the all-purpose trail, working on the extension coming all the way down across Interstate 80. They've got a section to finish yet that will dump into the Valley Parkway. So we continue to work with the city of North Royalton. Again, this adds further bolstered connections and frontage on Bennett Road.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the Zoo Community Engagement Project. This is the collaborative agreement. This the board had seen the first portion of it just most recently. This is the commitment to from the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo over the next three-year period to work with the Volunteers in Service to America here at the Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. This is the collaboration with Antioch University. They'll be working with local organizations, including Old Brooklyn, Brooklyn Center, Stockyards, Clark Fulton, Tremont, and a host of other community groups along the way. So this is the commitment of the Cleveland Metro Parks funds through Antioch University for the three-year period, an amount not to exceed $89,175.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is a continuation of the intergovernmental cooperative and mutual aid agreements. This one with the city of Cleveland and the village of Cuyahoga Heights is just a continuation of mutual aid jurisdictions and opportunities in somewhat clarifying fashions. The recommended action falls to enter into the two agreements and the top portion of page 15.
To approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item, the adoption of the revised code, we're actually going to pull and defer to the next meeting. We had a question that we were unable to clarify early this morning, so we'll be deferring it to the August meeting. That ends the action items this morning. We have award of tabulation and bids. We only have one of them this morning. Co-op purchase information technology equipment services falls on the top portion of page 18.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Approval of vouchers and payroll.
The following vouchers have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code totaling $10,526,669.08. And the recommended action falls on the bottom of page 24.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The second vouchers resolution also having been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with ORC is for a total of $123.57 specific to Arborware, and the action item falls on the bottom of page 25.
I will
approve.
Second.
Favor?
Aye.
We're done with this. Instruction change. Talked about that.
Yep. Public comments.
Public comments. Do we have any public comments? Yes. Good to have you back.
In the midst of the excitement of reopening, the recent drowning deaths are especially tragic. While they may have occurred in areas not specifically approved for swimming, Metro Parks may need to be more forceful in preventing future accidents. Simplest signage might say, no swimming outside designated areas. I am aware of the lifeguard shortage and saw that Lake Metro Parks is also cutting back their coverage. Also noted is that they've dropped parking fees for those unguarded periods, presumably to preserve their recreational immunity, since free parking will likely encourage visitation. Folks might still choose to swim outside lifeguard hours, but at least the most dangerous areas could be excluded. Visitors aren't really aware that some areas are particularly hazardous. Certainly putting more money toward safety should rank above staffing enterprise. particularly as selling drinks may actually increase risks in areas like the Huntington Steps and around water. Stinchcombe's Park did not encourage alcohol consumption or frame everything in terms of ability to generate money from visitors. On that note, one can only hope that the zoo zip line meets projections when it finally opens. Aesthetically, it certainly detracts from the zoo, which has worked through the years to create natural and attractive habitats. Your visitor survey showed the greatest opposition to fee increases to meet the cost of the park. Initial enthusiasm from expensive enhancements rarely continues long enough to pay off the investment. The projected income from attractions like Go Ape and 4D Theater has fallen short. The survey did not show interest in new stuff and rejected new fees. Good to see the emphasis today on walking and hiking trails. They are rated as high importance with natural surface preferred. Biking trails, however, are at the very bottom of the respondents' priorities, contrary to the vocal Bike Cleveland mountain bike community. Taken all together, folks are voting with their feet. So go with the good old park and take good care of it. Thank you.
Brian, is there anything that, I mean, obviously you can't protect everyone from drowning. Could we do anything else there? I mean, I think I don't think you can have guaranteed lifeguard service all the time by any means. I mean, in most places you don't have it at all. But is there a way to protect, these are children mainly, isn't that right? Biggest problem.
Not always.
Yeah.
I think first and foremost, our thoughts are with the families of these tragic accidents. Number one, I can say that, you know, this system was built on a riparian concept. So we have rivers that include the Chagrin River, Ohio and Erie, you know, the Cuyahoga River and the Rocky River, as well as Lake Erie, Huntington, Wallace, and a host of others. Water is an inherent risk, right? When we do our best to sign, and some folks still, you know, tend to work through, you know, some of the areas. And I think the answer is always, you know, retrospect, you know, what could you have done in this? There's always, you know, opportunities that we're constantly looking at. You know, there is an element of personal responsibility looking at some of those areas. So we constantly look at, we identify, we go through. And again, you know, our thoughts are with the families at this point in time.
Is there a point in doing, when you have something like that, to do sort of a post audit on what could have happened? That might be an interesting approach, just like an accident, you know, a military accident in training, always get sort of a, what might we have done differently? You know, and generally there's not a lot you could have done, but it's an exercise, process exercise.
Those are in general are done, correct?
Yeah. The other point about the zip line has a very specific objective. The point is not to forget it. It's not a joyride. It's an attempt to get an age group that don't participate enough in the zoo to come to the zoo. And that's the people that have gotten their driver's licenses and do other things. In that age group, they tend to do other things. So I think an interesting test would be how many more of those people do we draw? And I'm sure it will be self-liquidating. I'm not the slightest bit worried about that. But it would be very nice to be able to capture that age group a little more effectively than we've been. Thanks for your comment. Any other comments? Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Pastor Will Rothenbusch. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a citizen. Last week, Wednesday, we put to rest my best friend and two of his children that drowned in not Wallace Lake, but Wallace Quarry. That is a misnomer, and it's a very dangerous one. If you look at the photos that I have there, by the way, you can keep that. The first one shows on the Bagley side of that water, a little small ramp that you can walk over. It's maybe 12 feet long. It's maybe, you can see my umbrella there.
Yeah.
It's maybe 3 feet deep or whatever. It's very deceptive. And as you go along in the pictures, they get wider, they get deeper. In fact, I don't even know exactly where the quarry starts, where they actually quarried stone. But I do know that as you go along, it keeps getting wider. It keeps getting obviously deeper. Here's a fishing ramp. Then we're approaching the swimming area. And it's sort of like each time, like where the fishing ramp is, it widens out a little more. Where the swimming area is, it widens out a little bit more. And beyond the swimming area, it starts to get really treacherous.
That's where the quarry, the steep walls of the quarry start, is that?
Yes. And if you will look on page 12, you will see the area. You see the flowers?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the area now. When you go down that hill, and I think there's even one shot from the top of the hill, you can see the edge of the drop-off when the water is clear. If the water is troubled, you cannot see it. And the top ledge before you get to the drop-off is maybe 6 to 10 inches of water. That's where this girl was waiting.
Stepped off.
Obviously, yes. But the point is, there is no signage. There are no signs anywhere around that lake that says no wading, no swimming, life-threatening, warning, you're at your own risk. You have a father with his children. He would never take his children to a place that is clearly designated as a life-threatening situation. And if you look at the last pictures there, which show the actual fishing area, where there's a log, there's a stump there, sitting there. That area is all flat. But you can see where it goes out and where the drop-off is. Now, I'm not here to point any fingers. I'm not here to accuse anybody, because then I have to accuse myself too, because I've fished there many, many a time. Okay? Anybody could have thought, this is not a lake. This is a quarry. Why are there no signs to warn people? What if somebody comes here for the first time? They don't know what they're getting into. Why do we have to take a triple tragedy to find out there's an elephant in the room? This is the most dangerous body of water in the metro parks. And I had no idea. I kind of knew it used to be a quarry. I had no idea whether they filled in some of it or what. But there's mud, there's deep areas, there's extremely dangerous conditions there. And something needs to be done, so it doesn't happen again. We can't bring my friends back, but we can maybe save some other people's lives by putting some kind of signage, warning, do not enter this water at your own, life risk. swimming and wading only in the designated area. And boating, by the way, I have seen a couple of people, a young man and woman, they came in with their kayak in the same place where they drowned. Came right in there and landed. This is dangerous. We can't have this. We've got to do something. Either you got to fence the part off that's so dangerous, or you got to put somebody in a boat to rescue people, or you got to put a lot of signage. Signage is probably the easiest. Obviously, people can ignore signs, but I know my friend would not have ignored a sign. Not with his little children. He had a 2-year-old with him, and a 4-year-old, and a 6-year-old, and an 8-year-old that survived, and the 10 and the 12 that didn't. So please, do something. Please. That's all.
Thank you for your comments. Definitely. Make that safe. Yes.
We knew this family personally, and he would have never, never brought the children there if there was any possibility of danger. He was a very protective father. And I just want to tell you about my experience with quarries. You know, there are quarries on the Marblehead Peninsula, and I don't understand why people make parks out of them. I think it's foolish. I think it's wrong. I think it's dangerous. I almost drowned in the Marblehead Quarry up on the peninsula biking. I was hot and sweaty. The water looked so peaceful. It looked so, you know, I was literally 1 yard from the edge, and my left foot sank into quicksand. There is quicksand in these quarries. I don't know if you have ever studied the dangers of quarries, but we need to, if you have a quarry in the Metro Parks, there needs to be education. If my right foot had been where my left foot was, I felt it sucking down, I would not be here today to talk about it. So I did some research on the quarry waters. In Ireland, there are many quarries. They have huge signs that say cold water is a stone cold killer. The waters in the deep waters of quarries, not only quicksand, but debris and all kinds of other things, but the deep waters of the quarries go down sometimes 50 feet. They will kill you because of the shock of the cold water. You can't breathe. It's a terrible, terrible danger. That we need to have education in the schools. Forget about identity politics in the schools. Let's teach people how to stay alive in what we have. We have a lot of quarries in the United States. We have in the world, because it's a business, okay? Money is the god of this world, and we need to protect the innocent, the people that don't know. This was the first time the Lozutsky family had fished there, and to the people that told the news or whoever it was that said they came to swim is false, because none of them were wearing swimsuits. They don't even swim. They're very conservative. I'm sure the girl was in a long skirt just trying to cool off in the 90 degree weather. Seeing it seemed so innocent, you know, 6 inches of water. So there are all kinds of hidden currents, tunnels that drag you under in these quarries. They're much colder than a river or a lake. Again, I think you should change the name of the place. It should not be called lakes. We're conditioned by Lake Erie and our little fishing ponds and swimming areas. You know, we're conditioned to a gradated lake. This is not a lake. It is a quarry, and it needs to be identified as such. Again, signage is the easiest thing. No wading, no swimming. having the history of the quarry would be nice as well, a sign that describes what happened here 100 years ago with George Wallace, what they did, and what is in front of us. I hope I've said everything. It's been a very traumatic week for the whole community, and God help us if we don't do anything. So anyway, this is a copy.
Thank you very much for your comments. We'll see that something's done. Are there any other comments? Yes, please.
My name's Norm Plonsky, owner of Major Hoopoles, neighbor to the Red Line Greenway project that you guys just finished. And I would like to ask why the Metro Parks during the construction process thinks it's okay to put the public safety at risk and damage people's property. On the public safety issue would be that underneath the RTA bridge on Franklin, you needed to replace one of the light poles. And in the process, you turned off the power to the light pole on either side of the bridge, creating a dark zone. I informed you and the councilman of that issue, and you told me I would have to wait until all your poles were installed and power was brought back. We had to go through the riots with no lights down there, and then a month later, a person was assaulted in the dark zone, and a police report was filed and informed the Metro Parks and the City Council, and those two lights on either side were able to be put back on with minimal work. Otherwise, we would have had to wait 6 more months before we would have had power on the street. On the damaging of property, it would be my property, the patio to the business and the establishment. You had the hillside that you wanted to grade instead of putting in a retaining wall. And multiple times during the planning process, I told you this was a very bad idea and kept on telling me that it wasn't. And then when the project started, I brought your people back out to look at it, to see that it was a very bad idea. And again, you told me it wasn't. And then as it rained, like it does every spring, the flooding issue started slowly. Water, mud, all that good stuff onto my property, into my property. And you said, we're not done yet. When we're done, it won't happen anymore, which one, I don't think is an acceptable answer. But then it grew and grew until it blew through the fence of the patio, filled my patio with mud, where you can see the mud lines of feet of mud on the backside and on the inside of the patio. Street, every time it rained, was completely flooded with mud. I will say your people did clean up the mess, but we would have to live with the mess if it happened on a Friday till Monday. But I just don't understand. And then after the big flood, when you guys blew through the fence and put mud everywhere, you finally admitted to the flaw in the design and put in a retaining wall, which has rectified the situation. But I don't understand why I had to go through all that when it was obvious. Plus, I do believe it was a building code violation in the city of Cleveland. So I would like the Metro Parks to, when they come in the neighborhoods with construction projects, instead of just doing whatever's quick and easy for the Metro Parks, to actually be concerned about adjacent property owners. Thank you.
And what one?
Oh, hang on. Sean, do you have anything that, I'm just curious if there's any response to those concerns.
Sure, thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, good to see you. So through the design process and then through the construction process, we talked and met many and several times with Norm. So during construction, there is a period when you are sculpting, you are grading, and you're a little bit at risk because you have not done permanent stabilization in terms of seeding, in terms of matting. So Norm is correct. We did have some erosion issues during construction. The one major one that occurred, we were out there at 7 a.m. the next morning, power washed the patio, got everything off, and then we spent additional funds to just make sure that it would not happen again. And so since construction has finished, the slope's been stabilized, we spent those additional funds on a small retaining wall where we actually used rehabilitated stones that were salvaged from other projects. It looks fantastic. We put an additional drain tile. The permanent grading actually tilts the trail away from Hoople's and Mr. Plonsky's property. So the permanent condition, I hope, is good. I mean, I've gone there after every major rain, okay, especially the Friday before Memorial Day. And, you know, I have not seen any issues. So hopefully the permanent fix is good. Construction is always a little dicey when you're going through that in that interim process. When it comes to the lights, it's sometimes a little challenging to work with Cleveland Public Power. And so we actually got impatient as well. So we wired them back in. Okay. And had we waited, it would have been even longer. So a little give and take there. We're pretty satisfied with the end result. We're not seeing erosion. We're not seeing washouts. And you know, we hope that, yes, sometimes it's a little difficult to get there, but that the permanent fix, we stood to our word and actually did more.
And did you, were you going to say something?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm Lenny Stover. With no disrespect to the three people who have spoke previously about very serious issues, I'd like to speak about three very positive things that have happened at Metro Parks in the last 2 or 3 months. First, the Red Line Greenway had its grand opening on May 12th, and I want to thank Metro Parks for personally inviting me and Sean for reaching out because I wasn't reading my emails or answering phone calls during the pandemic. So it was great to be invited. I'm sure that wasn't the easiest thing to do because I've been an outspoken critic for wanting a world-class greenway. And I appreciate being invited and being there. Two other things happened. One was during that event, and you're all going to be jealous, but I got a man hug from Brian Zimmerman. That's right. It's like my daughter said, they make fun of when guys pat the each other on the back, but we did that. That's right. You all wish you could have one. That's right. And then finally, this is a little crazy, but Dan Moore, who had never, let me keep my act together, who would never seek publicity, said that he's crazy, but he said he'd rather be seen with a guy like me than some other people. And you're crazy. I don't know what you were thinking about that, but thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for those nice comments. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, excuse me.
On what just took place, so the comments. My name is Bobby Elias. I live in Brecksville. I ride the Valley Parkway frequently from my house in Brecksville, sometimes all the way to Emerald Necklace Marina. Just past Monday, I had an incident or an interaction with the Metro Parks police rangers. It was at the intersection of Valley Parkway and West 130th, where I stopped at the light. I was heading westbound, saw that there was no traffic coming either way. It was a red light going with me. I had a car come up from behind me. And when you're in those situations, you don't know, is somebody going to turn in front of you or are they right behind you? When I saw that there was no traffic coming either way, I proceeded to across West 130th on Valley Parkway. Didn't get very far, and I heard the bloop bloop of a vehicle and stopped, and it was a ranger who had stopped me, who then asked me, did I know why I was being stopped? And I said, I can assume it was because I went through the red light. We had an interaction. It was very cordial. He decided not to give me any kind of a warrant, but I went through our ticket. I went through and discussed with him kind of the interaction of bicycles on Valley Parkway with cars, all the intersections that are there. And it's kind of, are bicycles vehicles or are they pedestrians? And I think it's kind of in somewhere no man's land. I said, I consider the Valley Parkway kind of one of the jewels of the Emerald of the Metro Parks. I golf at Sleepy Hollow, and I will also consider that one of the great ones, but I will spare you any discussion on the greens or pin placements. In preparation to come, the ranger suggested I come here and speak with you to air, you know, kind of what things I had seen. And I, through my interaction or through my own research, I found out that Ohio Revised Code was revised a couple times, but the most recently effective in October of 2018, which essentially gives bicycles the right to go through a red light if they stop and see that there's traffic not coming either way. I may have that wrong, but certainly the ranger that I interacted with did not know that. So I would be, if there is somebody to confirm that, it's whatever, section 4511.132, which went through a series of challenges on that and discussed whether this should be or should not be possible. But more importantly, as I go through it and said, ride my bike there frequently, there are a number of intersections along Valley Parkway that there is no traffic control device for a bicycle going through. So you're left with, you know, waiting for a car to come up and activate the signal to change. Or you could, I guess this was suggested to me, cross over sometimes the whole street, sometimes just part of the path to get to the all-purpose trail to press a button to possibly get the light to change. I went through a number of intersections there, and when you really analyze it, even for the all-purpose trail, the signage and the controls for this are really not consistent. They're not appropriate. Some of them are bad. You go to Ridge Road and Valley Parkway, and there is a actuator button for a crosswalk. It is 30 feet away from the all-purpose trail, and the only sign is there can't be seen from the all-purpose trail. So my suggestion is, I think a study needs to be done of that whole corridor and all those intersections, and some changes need to be made to provide actuators for bicycles and even the ones that are on all-purpose trail, that there needs to be a number of revisions to some of those, because they're just not, they may have been put in at a time when the all-purpose trail was at a different place and they were never modified for the I guess the alternative alignment that was put in. But I think, I don't want to be dramatic in terms of, but I'm sure there are a number of incidents with bicycle cars, pedestrians, that could maybe be avoided if there is something done about some of these.
Thank you for calling that to our attention. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is the Valley Parkway busy enough to require a light for bicycles? I mean, isn't it? I don't think I've ever stopped for a light if there were no cars coming, riding my bike there.
Well, there's more and more lights being added. One that most recently was added at Broadview Road. There's now one being put at State Road. So there's more and more lights being there. There's still a number of stop signs. But so the trouble gets to be is there is, you know, there's actuators for cars. But if you're a bicycle riding on the road, not in, you know, if you're riding 15 to 20 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour, if you're going downhill, you can't ride on the all-purpose trail. So you're riding on the road. There's nothing there. There's a loop in them. Most of them have loops in the ground to actuate. If a car hits it, it will change the light after some period of time. It does not work for a bicycle. So there are alternatives. I think there's technology that can be done for bicycles to make that happen. And I think it's about time. And I'm not sure if they're your exact question, but I have seen over the last couple of years and indicated the same thing with golf. Valley Parkway is becoming more and more busy with bicycles. And that's every day of the week. It used to be just say Saturday or Sunday. Now it's every day. And again, it's a little bit maybe inconvenience, but it also is a safety issue in terms of bicycles going through there. And there should be accommodations in a Metro Park roadway. I'm not sure jurisdictions, but there should be accommodations for something that's used quite frequently by road bicyclists along that whole corridor.
Brian, let me ask a question.
What was the section again?
I'm sorry?
What was the section again?
I can get you this.
4511.132. So,
yeah, I got it.
But Brian, is it necessary? I mean, for someone that I understand when you're with your kids and you're riding with your kids, small children, you know, needing to cross with a light. But with a bicycle, if there's nothing coming, you know, why not just cross when you want to? I mean, you know, these are people riding on the street and accomplished bicyclists.
I can tell you when I ride, I stop.
Yeah.
It's
what the revised code tells you.
It's interesting. I mean, I put on 1,000 miles last year. And, you know, it's people that text, people that aren't paying attention. And to your point, I've been in those situations where the car, I don't know if it's going to come right over the top. Sometimes you have to back off. Sometimes you kick off your bike. I mean, lots of different scenarios can happen on any given ride for sure. We're going to look into it. I will tell you a lot of the traffic warrants, meaning the actual signalization, is actually controlled by the cities in which the municipality that we lie in. So we have some work to do. It's not always as cut and dry as, well, it's the Metro Parks or it's this. And so, you know, when the alignment went through, I'm sure there's always revisions. Certainly this is something that had been talked back in 2009 and now most recently completed. But again, I think the onus is on the cyclist to be paying attention to what's going on. And certainly we'll look into whatever the revised code tells us relative to that. But, you know, the onus is on the, you know, the cyclist to be, you know, mindful of what's going on. And you sounds like you cycle.
Yeah, but I think I think the revised code deals with your exact issue. Is that if it says you have to stop at the light, see that no traffic's coming, and then you're allowed to proceed through it. That's, I said, I believe that's it. Somebody can point out to me that I'm wrong.
It deals with a malfunctioning traffic light.
Read it, if you read the history of it, when it was first passed, it allowed any vehicle to go through.
But if it's been amended, but I think to your point, the larger issue is designing these systems so that there's less opportunity for conflict.
I agree.
And that's always a challenge, but it's certainly worthwhile.
If there's an actuator there, is it, do you consider an actuator if I have to walk 10 feet over there to push the button when I had to get off my bicycle to do that? I'm not sure it counts. Did I stop long enough to look at the traffic? Again, I can anticipate some interaction there. It would be more appropriate to go ahead and design the intersections for what happens.
Understood. That's why we're seeing a lot of rotaries, and they're hugely expensive. So sometimes the solution becomes truly problematic. But again, I think that the commitment generally with Metro Parks is where we can do kind of these partnerships, make it work, we'll try to do it. But some of these things are just going to be more difficult than others.
I understand, but then I would like to see what interaction took place on recent intersections, and that Valley Parkway, Broadview Road in Broadview Heights, and then it would be at State Road and
good point.
Valley Parkway in North Royalton. We're a new school going in there. If you showed me that there was discussion and because of various reasons and expense or whatever, that.
Yeah, it may well be that the projects are controlled by the municipality.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're not brought to the table. So it's a good point. It's good to create that opportunity.
Thanks for calling that to our attention.
Sean, do you want to answer?
Commissioners, we worked extensively with Broadview Heights and North Royalton on the two newer signals, so State Road and Broadview. And we really did, actually, interestingly enough, we concentrated with them a lot on how pedestrians, how the all-purpose trail, how bicyclists interact with those intersections, to the point of we worked with them on specific locations for actuators for not only the pedestrians on the all-purpose trail, but equestrians. So we have separate higher level push buttons for equestrians. When it comes to bicycles on the roads, if you look at Boulder, Colorado, if you look at Portland, Oregon, they do what is being suggested. But there are potentially some things that we can look at here. Those signals, I now believe, are using video detection. And video detection is much different than the loop inductors that are in the pavement. And a lot of times with the new video detection software, you can create different occupation zones. So you can set up, it's literally a box. And when that box has a car in it in the frame, it sends a message to the computer. The computer sends a message to the controller. We can work with them to see if we can set up a separate box where a bicyclist could or would typically be. So we'll look into it. It's something we can look into for more modern intersections.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll move into information and briefing items. Trails Division construction update. Jim?
Good morning.
So we enter 2021. The Trails Division did not exist until 2012. And this being our 10th season, it's our ninth year, but our 10th season, we are halfway through our most ambitious efforts to date. I'm going to highlight to you some things that are going on in the woods with our natural surface trails. Natural surface trails being hiking trails, bridle trails, and mountain bike trails. So to start us off. Some of the current projects we have underway that we're going to look at: Ohio and Erie Canal Mountain Bike Trail Expansion. It is our oldest mountain bike trail that we have in the park district. It currently runs about 2.5 miles. We're looking to more than double that in the near future. That is underway. Henry Church Rock out in South Chagrin, probably one of our most beloved and highly used trails that we have in the park district, has seen a wide array of issues out there that we're starting to address. No? I appreciate it. And then we've also brought on board, which was presented to the board for approval 2 months ago. We have now an Student Conservation Association youth trail crew that is reporting here at the zoo and then taken around to different areas around the park district to perform trail work for us. Some of our recently completed projects that we'll highlight is the Acacia Pond Trail, which is a new initiative out at Acacia to bring people closer to, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I never get asked to speak into a microphone, so they're usually like back away from the microphone. Acacia Pond Trail, which is bringing people closer to some of our amenities that we have out there. The Chippewa Gorge Trail, which in my opinion, and I think Ralph's on board as well, is our most impressive project to date as far as trail infrastructure goes. And then some of our upcoming projects that we'll look at that we hope to have finished by the end of the year, or at least started: the West Creek Overlook Trail Expansion, Lagoon Picnic Area Trail, and then the Ohio and Erie Canal Pump Track, which is going to correspond with the recent work that we're doing on the mountain bike trail itself. So these maps are not easy to interpret if you don't know what you're looking at, but they're more or less just to assure you that we do have a plan when we go into these projects. So this is the Ohio and Erie Canal mountain bike trail, and all this dotted line that you see, it's the star button. All the dotted line that you see is our current mountain bike trail. Just for reference, this is the Canalway Visitor Center. We are looking to expand this mountain bike trail by about 2.5 miles. And if you look here and you see the yellow and the green and the red and some of the black, this is going to be the new expansion of the trail. And then this area right here, which is currently an aggregate parking lot right off of the driveway to Canalway Center, is going to be where the pump track is going to be installed. So interestingly, that working down in the inner parts of the reservation on an area that's not naturally or known as being all that natural per se, some of the thickest natural conditions that we've seen. So this is us just going in right off the bat and starting to do some clearing for the new alignment. And you know, you're seeing, you know, this is some pretty serious vegetation that we're having to work our way through. The topography out here is ideal for what we want to do with it, and the soil types are ideal. I was not ready for the amount of clearing that we would have to perform by hand. But ultimately, if you look at this picture in the upper right-hand corner here, ultimately we were able to make our way through, and then once we were able to get a good alignment cleared, we were able to start bringing in our equipment to start speeding up the process. And with this project, we're utilizing our Student Conservation Association for a lot of the clearing. We're utilizing the trails crew itself, and we are utilizing a lot of volunteers. After we got to that point, this is our staff here working, but this is a contractor. So this is the first time that we've entered into an agreement with a trail building professional company to actually come in and do a lot of the heavy lifting for us. And now you can see here that this is the type of trail that we're creating out here. You can see the topography and how we're more or less benching into the slope there. That's going to, you know, basically provide us with a sustainable trail. After the rough machine cut trail is performed, we are now following up on behind them with our own volunteer efforts mostly. And we are doing the finishing work, which is work that you just have to do that by hand. There's only so much accuracy that you can get with a machine when you're working in these type of conditions. So the intent was always to utilize the trail contractor to rough cut, which is what you see here, and then to follow up behind them and do that that finish work by hand. So we're about halfway through our rough cut and clearing efforts out there with the intent to hopefully have the trail in a good spot by the time the rainy season comes, which is about mid-fall. With the soil that we have out there and the usership that we are expecting, we would love for that trail to kind of settle itself before, you know, allowing a heavy use aspect on it. So even though we will be rough cut and some of it finished, if as long as we can keep people off it until next season, the better. So we're going to monitor and see how it sets up on its own, and then we'll go from there.
How wide is that trail?
So typically we like to make the mountain bike trails up no more than 3 feet wide. Yep.
Perfect. And it's one way, correct?
It is one way. So most of our efforts with mountain bike trail, with the exception of West Creek, which generally speaking in a lot of areas has wider trail, we will provide signage that directs people to use the trail in one direction on certain days of the week and then in the opposite direction on certain days of the week. And if you go to Bedford and Royal View, it's been working actually very, very well. We were a little skeptical that people would follow, but much to our surprise, everybody's on board with it and it seems to be working out very well. So we also see a large faction of hikers on our mountain bike trails as well. And if the hikers know which way the mountain bikers are traveling, yeah, then they tend to go the opposite way so they can see each other coming down, you know.
And that's allowed, correct? I mean,
I'm sorry?
We're comfortable with hikers.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, some of our monitoring on some of our trails almost sees a 1-to-1 ratio of mountain bikers versus hikers for whatever it's worth. Yep. So this is Henry Church Rock. Henry Church Rock in South Chagrin takes us down to a very historical overlook. Again, the trail plan is not so easy to decipher on the large screen here, but long and short of it is the parking lot sits up here and there's a trail on the upper bluff here that will, it's an all-purpose trail that gets you to the overlook. There's a set of steps on this side and a set of steps on this side that gets you down to the river's edge. And this is the trail here that we're looking to bring back to acceptable condition. So the first thing, I'm sorry.
And Jim, these are sort of trails that are sort of there now, bootleg trails. Sort of.
So the Henry Church Rock Trail is a sanctioned, mapped, very highly used trail.
Okay.
Absolutely. We'll get into West Creek where we can start dealing, and Lagoon where we start looking at some of the bootleg efforts.
Okay.
Yep. So Henry Church Rock has seen a large amount of use and erosion over the past year or two. And the winter storms that we had primarily in December and in March of 2020 and 2021 really did some significant damage out there. We had a lot of downed trees. We had a lot of runoff erosion issues. And we started losing sections of the trail. And when this gets slippery, you know, then people have a tendency to go a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And then suddenly we start getting more erosion on the toe of the slope here. So finally we said, okay, we're to a point now where we have to go in and we have to do a substantial project on this lower portion. So through donations, we were able to mobilize a crew in. And again, we're utilizing an outside contractor. This time it's the American Conservation Experience, which we also known as the ACE crew. And we basically hired a group of four to come in and work on a 5-week project which was going to be the heavy lifting and the primary focus of the first phase of this, which was building the 70-foot retaining wall to get people into a comfortable place that they can walk on the hillside and not have to worry about further erosion down into the river. So we moved 20 tons of stone by hand in 5 weeks. And you'd need to be a special type of person to agree to take on projects like this. And the good thing about the ACE crew is, you know, they're basically college kids that are off school for the summer, but they have a deep passion for trails. And if you don't have somebody that has a deep passion for trails working on a project like this, the effort just doesn't seem to work out. So Ralph and I both thought that this was a perfect place where we could bring in a specialized trail crew to do a project like this, which for handwork is pretty significant.
And so, what sort of equipment do they bring with them?
So they don't bring any equipment. They don't even bring a car. We provide them with a place to live, and we provide them with a vehicle, Metro Parks vehicle, that they can use to shuttle themselves to and from the job. All the material, and they bring hand tools. All the material and any type of equipment that we need to do the projects, we provide for them, and that's part of the contract.
And what is roughly the cost, the hourly cost?
So we have a five-week stint that we just finished in the summer, and they are actually coming back for another seven-week stint. So we have them for 12 weeks total, and we are just right around $45,000.
Four guys. Okay.
Four people. So there was talk about possibly providing two more people for the next round, which is going to be in the early fall. So it could be a crew of six in the fall. We're waiting to work out those details.
Sounds great.
So how do you get these 20 tons of stone down to the bottom of the hill without running equipment? Because there's staircases on both sides. And it's a very natural protected area. So grip hoists, high lines, and little dollies that we made out of old lawnmower parts and a steel frame. And then we basically created a railroad on the side of the hill. So we would use the high lines. So we got the material to this point here, which is basically off the all-purpose trail at the top. And we would use the high lines to lower them down with grip hoists. We basically suspended them from a cable and walked them down the side of the hill, got them to an initial landing, and then loaded them on a dolly for that final descent from this point here down to the retaining wall itself. So 5 weeks, 20 tons. If you were using an excavator, not very impressive, right? If we're using four people and just their right and left arms, pretty impressive work that these guys were able to do. We did throw our staff out there on occasion to help set up the high line. You know, the ACE crew didn't have much experience doing this type of setup. So we set up all of the transport infrastructure, and then we trained them how to use it, and then they kind of took it from there. So at the end of the day, this is what they were able to build. This is the four ACE crew members that we had here, which were an absolute pleasure to work with. So they, opportunities and conservation groups like this for sure have a place in the Metro Parks Trails Division to utilize, without doubt. So phase one of Henry Church Rock Trail has been complete. We are now sending in a group of volunteers to get the trail itself into a good place where we can open it to the public for the remainder of the summer. And then we are planning on sending the same ACE crew back into this location when they come back for their second stay with us to do additional work. Nothing as ambitious as this. It's going to be more smaller scale. But this just shows you the kind of craftsmanship that we're pushing for on these Beautiful. On these projects. And then the SCA Youth Trail Crew. So the SCA, Student Conservation Association, which is very similar to ACE, a little bit more expansive in what they provide. But we were able to partner up with them and more or less hire a crew of six youth trail workers who are monitored and directed by two adult leaders. They work Monday through Thursday with us, with their Friday being a leadership and development opportunity. So they're here, but they're not doing trail work. They're visiting the zoo, they're doing leadership activities, team building, you know, that type of thing on their Fridays. So they've been now with us for about 3 weeks. We are seeing very positive attitudes from them, which is the most important thing. And we are starting to see them really ramp up with their with what they're being able to provide us. So when we'll look at Gorge in a second here, but they are providing assistance with restoration on our Gorge Parkway. They're partaking in our trail signage initiative, which is a multi-year project that's been going on now for year three. And then this is them partaking in some of the clearing that's happening at Ohio and Erie Canal. So Ralph grew up in these types of organizations. He's very committed to maintaining a relationship, and he just loves the opportunity that we're providing these kids. So he's very engaged on a day-to-day basis, and he gets more excited the more that he sees their capabilities and what they're able and willing to do. The more excited he gets, because that just, you know, we're sending them to North Chagrin, we're sending them to South Chagrin, Rocky River. We're moving them all around the park district, providing, you know, beneficial work to us, and the kids are really starting to buy into it, and it's really fun to
watch. Are the SCA kids high school or college?
They're all high school.
They're all high school.
Yep.
So juniors and seniors, probably.
Sophomores, juniors, and seniors. That is correct.
Okay.
Yep. And we've had, so the SCA, they program and facilitate the program all on their own. We're simply a partner with them. We're a resource for them to utilize. They advertise for these jobs, and we all hear about the job market and, you know, trying to get, you know, seasonal help is tough. So we had almost four times as many applicants as we had available spots, which really surprised me, because this is not an easy sell for high school kids to come do for the summer. We're not talking about, you know, anything that could be considered not strenuous. Everything that they're doing, to provide, you know, some type of strenuous activity. And I was a little unsure that we were going to be able to, you know, attract a good pool of candidates, and I was completely wrong. In fact, we've already had two people that for personal reasons have had to bow out of the program, and we had no problem going to that list of other applicants to basically backfill.
But these aren't Cleveland kids, though, are they?
So they didn't say that you had to live in a specific region.
Yeah.
But they've concentrated their efforts on recruitment on Cuyahoga County, City of Cleveland. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So this has been a great opportunity, and, you know, with the results that we're seeing, it looks like we've, you know, took ourselves into a very positive relationship going forward. So, and then the Acacia Pond Trail is one that we've recently completed. This is bringing, and this is all donor funded as well. Up to this time, it was basically all purpose trail that we had out there, which is, you know, golf cart paths. And we're now able to bring people closer to the amenities that in the past the golf course tried to keep people away from, which is like this pond. So this was just a mowed grass area around this pond. And in a very brief time, we were able to go in there, construct some elevated trail and boardwalks, expand the wetland opportunities around the pond, and then provide the users for a little bit more natural setting in an area that once, you know, really didn't have any formalized way to get to. So,
beautiful.
And then the Chippewa Gorge Trail. So the Chippewa Gorge Trail is an area of the Metro Parks that is one of the most scenic that I've come across in my tenure here, and there was no official trail network to get you down there, but that didn't stop people from going down there. So over the course of discussions and through a very generous donation, we came up with a plan here to get people down to the bottom. It's very hilly and it's very rocky. And on October 29th, 2019, we set our first two stones. And we worked through about Thanksgiving and then had to shut down for the winter. And right when we got ramped back up at the beginning of 2020, then the pandemic hit. And if you see how we do this type of work, there's no easy way to do this and maintain social distancing. If you're moving a rock that weighs 400 pounds, you can't do that by yourself, and you have to be right next to the person that you're working with, or two or three people that you're working with. So as things calmed down a little bit and we kind of started to understand exactly how we could go about doing things going forward, we're able to remobilize out there in the summer of 2020. And the primary efforts out here to begin with were rock staircases. And you can see here, you know, this is the grip hoist that I'm talking about. We're basically suspending these large rocks and we are lowering down the hill using come-alongs and chains and other cables. So, and then a lot of these rocks don't come, you know, building steps, a lot of them don't come with this finished flat edge to use as a safe. So we have to drill holes and pop rivets in them to make sure that they break on a very, you know, so we're talking about almost WPA type techniques that we're using out here. We could saw it, absolutely, but when you're looking at the long-term sustainability and you know, trying to do things the right way, there was no other option in my mind than to figure out how to do these types of projects the way that they would have done them 100 years ago. So after a year working out there last fall and then into this summer, we were able to construct these two large staircases, which more or less take you down to the area that everybody wanted to get to, which is the scenic overlook down in the gorge. And then on top of that, we were also able to utilize some new techniques that we're starting to, you know, go after. And this is a new form of natural wood staircase that kind of fits the atmosphere out there a little bit. These modest little bridges where, in the past, we would maybe clear on the uphill side and build a more traditional bridge. And now we're starting to migrate towards these little less impactful, but very functional walkways, boardwalks with handrails, and then log steps as well. After we do all of our work, we're in the process right now of going back and taking out the old trail network, but also erasing our footprints that we had to make to go in and build these things. So this is an example of a restored corridor that used to be a heavily used trail. And after the new trail got put in, we want people more or less to stay out of it and let nature take itself back over. So this is an example of our restoration efforts. These are our restoration efforts around the staircase where there obviously was a little bit of disturbance. And then here is one of our haul roads that we are going in and basically removing our haul road and restoring those areas back to nature as well. So, and then some upcoming ones that I'll touch on real quick and hope to have updates for you in the near future. So in 2018, we partnered with the hiking club and created this overlook trail that came from the Keystone Shelter, which is more or less right here in West Creek, up this one-way trail to just to our property line. And we put this overlook structure that you see here is right here on the edge of our property line. And, that was a donor or a grant issued funding for this, and it's been very, very popular. The problem is you get to the top and the only other option that you have with sanctioned trails is to turn around and walk back down. And while it was heavily used, it's not necessarily the ideal situation of what we push for trails. So we were able to work through our legal department and get permission from WKYC, which owns this parcel right here, and more or less allow the overlook structure now to become just a stop along the way. And we're able to expand our trail, the overlook trail, onto their property, and then through phase one, and then phase two is going to expand onto their property even more and connect all the way down to the all-purpose trail network that we have through West Creek as well. So we have now entered into an agreement with a different professional trail building contractor that's the same approach as the Ohio and Erie Canal Mountain Bike, which they're going to go in, they're going to rough cut everything, and we're going to follow behind them with our skilled crews. We're going to do the finishing work and then be able to let the public on this. One of the more intriguing aspects of this project is all this railroad type lineage that you see here. These are all bootleg, unsanctioned trails. And a huge effort in this project is going to be taking all of this out. So at the end of the day, all of these bootleg trails, which are an environmental impact to the natural surrounding, are going to be removed through our restoration efforts like you were seeing in this picture and also out at the Gorge Parkway, and ultimately providing such a nice experience on a very sustainable dry trail that people are going to want to stay on this trail itself, and then we're going to stop all this unnecessary impact in the surrounding area. So while trail building and trail maintenance is a large part of what we do, Ralph is very, very dedicated to sustainability and to natural resource protection, and this is a great example of that. Lagoon Picnic Area in Rocky River. So this is a heavily used area. We've gotten our nature center area all squared away with the new bridge and the boardwalks and everything, Fort Hill Steps, which is hugely popular. And just moving ourselves to the next segment south, we come upon this Lagoon Picnic Area, which is a very heavily used location for not only fishing in this old Oxbow here, but there's also a rentable pavilion that's here as well. In addition to that, on the west side of the valley, up top here, very Fort Hill-ish type, is a large network of non-sanctioned bootleg trails that are actually, this is one a picture of one of those, they're in really good shape. The people have kind of chosen to put the natural trail that they see because they want to use the area in a location in this situation that's actually really good, really nice. And there's really no reason for us to not have a sanctioned trail up there, as people are going to use this area anyway. So the intent of this project is to formalize the trail network on the upland part of this. There are areas where we have mud holes and people are kind of building their own little bridges, which is unique, but not necessarily, what we go for. So formalizing the trail network on this side of the valley, connecting to the Bridle Trail, connecting to the Lewis Road Riding Rink here as well, and then the Maple Grove Picnic Area, which has a Bridle Trail connection, is also down here as well. But also providing better trail experiences around the lowlands lagoon area itself, including some new fishing platforms. So we're going to provide some new protruding wood fishing platforms that will allow people a better experience down here, as well as kind of clean up this whole network of lower trail that we have for not only the fishermen to use, but anybody utilizing this pavilion, they can use it as well. And then the Ohio and Erie Canal, in conjunction with the mountain bike trail, we're also going down, and we are in a contract now with a very, very reputable design build company called American Ramp Company out of Missouri to build the first section of our first pump track. So we had a preliminary design meeting on this past Monday, and all the feedback that I'm getting is, you know, from my standpoint, this company absolutely knows what they're doing. They've built these types of facilities in 40 countries around the world and in every state in the United States. And they are very excited with the opportunities that they see here, not only with phase one, but with the possible couple other phases that we're looking at down the road. As soon as we get the first phase in the ground and see, you know, how everybody's utilizing it and going after possible grant opportunities to provide some type of, you know, competition track in addition to this, or some type of children's, you know, less advanced track, so we can have opportunities for, you know, any user that happens to show up. In addition to all of that, this is going to be connected to the mountain bike trail network that we're building at Ohio and Erie Canal. So more or less, we're going to take Canalway and kind of, you know, make it a place that mountain bikers or any type of trail users are going to want to go park their car, and they have a wide array of opportunities there, not only on the mountain bike trail or on the pump track, but then obviously, you know, getting connected to the towpath right there and then taking that all the way into downtown Cleveland. So I'm very excited about what the future holds for the whole Canalway area with these efforts. This project right here, we are working through preliminary design phases, and we hope to break ground in the early fall. This will be an asphalt track as well, which means we don't have to worry about long-term maintenance, because people love to ride these things, not necessarily when the weather isn't conducive to it. So we didn't really see much success or potential success trying to close these things down to try to keep people off them in the colder and wetter months. And the feedback we got from American Ramp Company was, you know, let's pave this thing. You know, it's going to be a small impact. There's not a whole lot of pavement that we're adding. It's an existing non-pervious aggregate parking lot anyway. Let's pave this thing, so that's going to be the best long-term product that we can give people. So these are just stock images that they provided us. Our final image, they're looking on a conceptual drawing right now that I hope to have to me in the next week or week and a half. And then there's some permitting issues that we're going to work through, and then hope to break ground here in the next month and a half or 2 months. So one other thing I'd like to add, through the efforts of the development division, everything we just talked about is 100% done with either donated funds or grants, which is just absolutely astonishing to me. So I could not be more fortunate to be on the receiving end of all the efforts of the development division in particular. So so with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you guys have.
I think this is a wonderful presentation, and it shows the initiative that we're taking for the bicycling community. It's going to pay huge dividends, and I love the way you're doing it.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
I agree. That was fabulous. So some of the stuff you guys and your team are building are just beautiful. Amazing. So
great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Ralph, and the entire crews. The next info item is the Acacia Clubhouse condition assessment.
Commissioners, would like to run through the Acacia Clubhouse condition assessment. It's a little hard to follow after Jim's presentation. But what we'd like to do today, and just to give you all a little bit of grounding, what we're talking about is that former private country club clubhouse for Acacia Country Club as part of the reservation. But let's start big and then work our way in. So Acacia reservation itself has grown. We have picked up some additional property to 156 acres. Is that right, Kyle? 156.7 or whatever it is now. Thank you. And so we're guided at the reservation by our reservation master plan, of which we have one for each reservation. That is important here at Acacia, but what is also equally, if not more important, is the fact that we have an ecological restoration master plan. And we have gotten a tremendous number of things done, both that were called for on the preservation master plan and the ecological restoration master plan. We have removed numerous structures from the site and restored those areas to nature. With the house that we also purchased on the north side of the property, we've taken that down as well. So we've really let the site breathe more and done exactly what the intention was in the ecological restoration master plan. We have volunteers that helped us plant over thousands and thousands of trees. And that's, again, a good step here. At Acacia, we have improved more than 1,500 lineal feet of stream, restored 14 acres of wetlands. Here's that finished photo that Jim was talking to you about. It looks like we actually coordinated our presentations. This is Acacia Pond, where the trail network now has been improved around that pond. We have now acres and acres of meadow starting to be restored along those former fairways. We have repaved the entire all-purpose trail network in the park, and the amount of traffic and strollers and rollerbladers is just quite amazing. We have current improvements going on. So again, we're talking specifically about the clubhouse here, but as we speak, we have the shelter, which was the former cart barn, under renovation. We are converting that to a reservable pavilion. We've got public restrooms facing outward to the park that will be ADA accessible. Today, we do not have accessible restrooms there, so that is a challenge. We are rectifying that. We'll then have internally facing restrooms for the reservable pavilion, a very cool open air sitting area, a plaza. So these are renderings of the work that is currently going on out at Acacia. So what the real purpose for the next few minutes is to talk about that former, you know, private country club clubhouse, as it has been presenting challenges and is about to become even more challenging. So the building itself, constructed in 1995, just over 33,000 square feet. So that is a large structure. It is on several levels. So that main level is about 21,000 square feet, consists of ballroom, full kitchen, offices, locker rooms, restrooms. There is an upper level in the building that consists of about 4,500 square feet and a very large lower level subterranean with storage, mechanical space. It's quite a lot of just open space, not very well utilized. The building itself is fully fire suppressed, has one elevator, an amazing amount of fixtures, 26 toilets, 17 sinks. So that is intensive to manage, a full commercial kitchen. Construction type is what you would expect from the mid 90s. It's got CMU foundations, wood studded frame walls, some steel beams in the basement. The basement's very well constructed. I think we would argue that perhaps the wood frame portion could be a little different, but it is what it is. We assume this building as is. It's got some cementitious lap siding, asphalt shingle roof, and then a rooftop unit for its HVAC system on the top of the roof, roof itself. It's operated primarily, although we do have many public events and we use it for our own operations. We do have Dino's Catering currently acting in a management services agreement capacity. That arrangement expires at the end of December. And with that, we bring that up because we need to decide what to do next so that we're planning effectively.
How's it doing? Is it pretty active or is it?
It's not doing great. And that's one of the reasons why the agreement is not being extended.
Got it.
We have been working with Dino's. I think Joe and Brian had to dive out, but we've been working with Dino's. I don't know, Bill, if you want to add anything about some of the challenges they've had. And we're at a point where that December date is a hard date for them.
Yeah, the challenge is and it's on here. We're going to talk about it. They have to do great to break even there. It's an expensive facility for them to operate. It's very difficult to climate control weddings. There are often complaints in the summertime that it just can't be cool enough when everything is running at full capacity and even when it's been cool days in advance. So utility bills there, electric in particular, are really challenging. To give you a rough idea, I think the last couple of years, they're running in the mid-70s to $80,000 a year just for electricity, and that is down. We've put in some money along with Dino's to try to manage those costs. We can't seem to get them any lower than that. That's been the trend now for about the last 2 or 3 years, and they were up over six figures prior to that. So, and that's just electricity. So the amount of activity and volume that Dino's has to put through is making this cost prohibitive for them.
Are you going to get to it? I don't want to jump ahead, but obviously last year, bad year, no big events. Do you know if they're seeing a surge in activity this year with people now having weddings and things, or is it still just a little generally slow because it's not the best location?
They have definitely picked up in terms of usage. The activity is there, but it's not enough that it's driving real profitability for them. So it's been mutual discussions about the lack of extension of the agreement with them. It's really hard for them to make money there.
So they're not necessarily interested either in an extension.
Correct.
They actually asked to be relieved of it.
Okay. Yeah. Great. That's important.
In the past few years, we've had some pretty major challenges and costs related to the fire suppression system. It's a unique system, and we've found that, especially when we get a polar vortex or deep freezes, that the insulation isn't the best in the building. So we've had pipe bursts, we've had some flood issues that we've had to address. It's costly, it is disruptive, and you just can't anticipate when those things are gonna happen. In addition to that, because of the way the building was set up, those insulation matters, the whole building is controlled by these two rooftop units. And to Bill's point, when you have a wedding in the summer and you know it's in the 80s and 90s, you want to keep the bride and groom happy. That has not occurred at all times. So it's been a challenge. To Bill's point also on the utilities, and this is just a quick study that Bill and team put together. We wanted to see how does this stack up versus Manikiki, and there's a ton of numbers on here, and I don't want to just kind of drown you with them, but here's the interesting thing if you look at the bottom. When you look at what it costs to operate Acacia versus Manikiki Clubhouse, and keep in mind, Manikiki Clubhouse also has an operational, you know, full golf operation clubhouse, if you will, in addition to the catering component, so there's more, arguably more activity in the building. The cost to operate Acacia versus it, 88% higher, 107%, so more than double in some years. So it is an intense building in terms of utility consumption and viability. Bill, do you want to add anything to the
work? The numbers kind of speak to themselves. I mean, maybe the only one thing to add is this is where you can see there has been an effort to get that downward trend. Obviously, 2020 is down because it wasn't utilized as a building. It was shuttered for much of the pandemic period. But this is about as much as we can push that down, and it's still trending at like Sean said, basically double the cost of Manikiki, which has much more operational usage out of it during the year.
So we're looking at, you know, what is the potential? If we have a building that will no longer have an agreement to occupy that building, knowing that we've got a reservation master plan, knowing that we have an ecological restoration plan, you know, do we look at the potential to raise the building? Do we look at the potential to include, you know, what we're showing here is likely another 3 acres of restoration area. So we're at that point in the process. We're, you know, we're looking forward to December. We don't want December to come and then say, okay, what are we going to do? So we're having the discussions now about, you know, what is next, what are the right next steps, what further do we need to do? And we think one of those options is continuing to see restoration in the park and perhaps allow this area as well to return to nature.
Sean, what the original donors of the Acacia, didn't they want us to tear it?
Brian,
I think the overall intent is to see more natural realm there, and I think that was one of the discussions amongst many. I mean, there's a square foot allotment for impervious surface, and I think certainly this would be within the donors, you know, overall wishes. I think we've been able to accommodate the potential for what we would call a, you know, picnic-like shelter facility again, I think the overall operational challenges of operating a golf course clubhouse to that degree, again, with the insurmountable numbers, the level of subsidy that the park would have to continue to bring in is fairly insurmountable. So I think there's some options as we can continue to move forward, but we just wanted to make sure that the commissioners knew that we've been studying, you know, what this actually looks like.
Do we have any costs to
them? We have put together some costs. We've actually asked a reputable demolition contractor to take a look at it. We think we're in that 340 to 360 range, which quite frankly isn't that bad. The decision we need to make is, are we taking the full basement out? Are we going to leave part of the basement in place? It's a substantial basement. So those are all the things where we can be a little flexible with cost.
Would we consider a second shelter building or a second outdoor building? I know you're just building the first one, but I still feel like that could be an area that could, you know, sustain a lot of.
I think we actually looked at it, and there's actually there's a square foot calculation that only allows so much impervious surface per the agreement, the gift agreement. We had looked at one opportunity out in the middle part of the property.
But if we take this whole building down, is that removing?
Correct. I think it's just, it'll be an interesting balance to see how, you know, how the property could look going forward.
There's one thought that came up the last time we talked about this, which is talking to the clinic about it. There's sort of a wellness, you know, across Richmond is at the old TRW site. There's a wellness facility. It wouldn't be a bad idea just to run it by someone from Holovic's office just to see if there's any interest.
We can. Thank you, Sean.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
There is no regularly scheduled business. There is no old business. The next meeting is Thursday, August 19th. There is an executive session for the purpose of acquisition of real property. Karen?
Is there a motion to go into executive session to discuss the purchase or acquisition of real property?
So moved.
Second.
Passes.
Dan Moore? Debbie Berry?
Yes.
Bruce?
Make a motion to adjourn the meeting?
A second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.